what should we talk about in the intro?
Well, I think we should give it... I like that we do it after the interview, because then we know what to set up.
That's true, yeah. About classic music videos. Do you want to talk about classic music videos?
Sure. Which classic music video?
Well, I'm you know, lately on podcast and the site, we've been talking about lots of new music videos, and there's so much awesome stuff going on in music videos right now, but there's such a great and storied history of music videos to sort of get into, and we'll get into that in future podcasts, but I've been sort of spending a few hours over the past few days looking at sort of these different magazines and blogs, top 50 or top 100 videos of all time. And I'm thinking in terms of iconic videos, Doug. Iconic music videos.
Okay.
If you had to pick the most iconic music video of all time, just off the top of your head, I didn't prep you for this at all, for people listening, what would that be?
God, I'd say it would be a toss up between either Sabotage by Beastie Boys, or I'm pretty sure it's got to be Sabotage, because I think it's Weapon of Choice, which is the song with Christopher Walken dancing.
Yes,
but I wasn't positive about that, and because of my not being clear on whether or not that was the right song, Sabotage wins by default. So Sabotage, Beastie Boys.
That's a great video, and actually, that's one that is sort of the one, I guess, one of the precursors of Ryan McNeil's video for Grums Through the Night. It's a
I'd say it's a precursor to a lot of videos.
It is, and if you haven't seen it, it's sort of this over-the-top cop music video. And to say
Spike,
that...
Spike Jones?
Spike Jones, who it has a bit of a name in music videos, so I hear. But it's, yeah, director Spike Jones in 1994. So that's kind of a golden age of music videos. When you say the sort of the 90s, I remember a lot of the new music videos coming around that time.
Yeah,
really
it seems
had that
like
special quality.
It seems like whenever you know, somebody makes reference to like back when music videos were big, they always say Spike Jonze and Michelle Gondry, who make videos at the same time. You know what? They're the trend of those videos is a budget.
Wait, say that again. Your internet's busted.
Yeah, it is my internet's. This series of tubes is not working properly. What am I saying again? Should I start over from the top? Sabotage, Beastie Boys is my most iconic video.
No, not bad.
I know. What I'm saying is the trend is a big budget.
Well, back then, because that back then, you know, MTV played the music video, so
that's
you would
what
get
I mean, yes.
You would get
what I'm saying.
Like some of these videos, like the Meatloaf video that
Bad Outta Hell.
Bad Outta Hell. That I think it was I'd Do Anything for Love. Who directed that? Michael Bay. Michael Bay used to direct music videos, and they were awful. The I Would Do Anything for Love music video is actually, just because it's so goofy and sort of iconic, is great, but. I think the record for the biggest budget ever for a music video is the Michael Jackson,
Latoya.
Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson's video for Scream, which I think the budget came in at $7 million, and that was directed by Mark Romanek. obviously you don't
get... Which to me is ridiculous. I feel like that video now could be achieved on such a smaller budget.
Yeah, I mean, looking at it, it's nothing crazy fancy. I mean, I think they had to film a few weightlessness scenes in one of those airplanes that just takes a nosedive, which sounds like a real fun environment to film in. But
yeah, that's not tough at all.
Yeah, no, that's really...
With Michael freaking Jackson, though.
Oh, man. God. But I mean, in all honesty, I think it'd be really great to kind of figure out a sort of eras of music videos when we're talking about these things, because I can pick out, or in my mind, you know, different music video eras. I mean, starting in the 70s, when you know, their music videos, like people like ABBA were doing music videos, which are some of the most hilariously awful music videos I've ever seen in my life. If you want to see just like people trying to figure out how to make music videos and just failing awfully, you have to see ABBA's video for money, however money there is in the title, or Take a Chance on Me. They're just awful. And then you sort of get into the 80s thing, where people are starting to do more interesting things, and you know, we have MTV come along, and there's much more of a place for people to, you know, exhibit those music videos. More people are seeing MTV in their homes, so you're seeing, you know, really interesting things like Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer video. And then you get into sort of the early 90s, where MTV is just exploded, and, you know, they run a mix of programming of things that, I mean, I know I was watching as a kid, like the Tom Green Show. And then they were also playing music videos, and most people, or at least most people I knew, got MTV2, which just played all these music videos. So you had things like R.E.M.'s Losing My Religion, you know, a lot of great Smashing Pumpkins videos. You also had things like, what is that one? Like, these are some of the classic Bjork videos coming out of that time.
You also got all the Bad videos, and they would play those on Beavis and Butthead.
Exactly, yeah. Oh my God, I remember those. Those are
so like, they would still get traction out of the shit.
Oh, and you can still get Beavis and Butthead on Netflix. So that's a great way to.
Does it have? Because here's something that is actually pretty interesting. It kind of goes with what you're saying. Does Beavis and Butthead still have the music videos in it on DVD? Because I think it's just compilation of the bits of the like storylines.
Is it? I'll have to check.
Because when you buy Daria, it's got all new music in it.
Really?
And there's even a little insert in the DVD package. Apologizing that all the 90s music is not in there. I swear, it's like the first thing you may notice when you watch Daria is that all the 90s music is gone. It's like, that's because we can't afford it. It's like literally like very upfront like that. It's like it doesn't talk like me, but it is like basically like we can't afford it. We didn't consider DVDs in the early 90s, and so here's this shitty fucking stock music. Put that. Enjoy Daria. For the listeners who haven't heard, Beavis and Butthead is a really great show, you guys.
Highly recommend. And the movie, Beavis and Butthead Do America. Didn't we see that together in the theaters and like that?
I definitely saw it in the theaters. It definitely came out when we were in middle school. And yeah, so I would go with yes.
Probably. We also saw Kazam in the theaters.
Yeah, we did. And Austin Powers, so we didn't see all bad movies.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But I remember we had to go to this, like theater that was just, like, falling apart.
The only one that my parents would take us to, because this is great for our listeners. This is, honestly, when Isaac listens to this podcast, to hear it for his interview, and he's gonna be like, oh shit, I got set up by a fucking movie story about Doug going to the movies with Adam when they were in middle school. Oh my God, this is gonna be great.
Ladies and gentlemen, on the podcast today, We have the pleasure of talking to Mr. Isaac Rentz, who is a really fantastic music video director, and I highly recommend searching for his name on the site and checking out all of, if not some of, his music videos. Sorry, some of, if not all of, his music videos before listening to the podcast. You can get a little bit of taste of what you're about to hear.
Why don't you just go ahead and watch all of them?
Yeah, go ahead and watch all of them, definitely, because they're great bands and they're great music videos. And Isaac is started out as a graphic designer and moved his way into music video directing. And this is a fantastic interview because he has some really great thoughts on band participation in music videos. He has some really great stories about getting, you know, into the music video business and sort of because even though he's a young guy, his music video career has spanned, you know, smaller bands from just a few years ago in 2007, and his recent video, like our segue, so perfectly frames, had Topher Grace in it because it was the music video for Atomic Tom's "Don't You Want Me" for the new movie "Take Me Home Tonight," starring Anna Faris and Topher Grace. So anyway, this is Isaac Rentz. And let's check it out.
Well, my name's Isaac Rentz. I've been directing music videos and commercials for about 3 or 4 years now. Well, probably three, like, full-time. I live in Los Angeles. And this podcast is off to a really bad start.
No, well, actually, you know, we've been checking around for you on the internet, and with every web page, we find some more interesting stuff about you. And actually, one thing people might find interesting right off the bat is you're actually from Japan. You're raised in Tempe. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I was born in Japan. I lived there for about 3 or 4 years, and then I was really raised in Arizona, and I moved out to Los Angeles about 5 or 6 years ago, just wanting to do music videos and stuff like that. So I really haven't been in Los Angeles too long.
And you're the first music video director I think we've come across that sort of has a background in graphic design, because I know you worked at, you know, several independent record labels doing, you know, graphic design for bands, for cover albums and things like that. And you said you wanted to do music videos in Los Angeles. How was that kind of a transition for you? Was it always, you know, your goal to eventually do music videos, or did you kind of, you know, get into it by being in the music industry?
Well, you know, I actually never thought I'd be doing any of this stuff. When I was in college, I got a history degree. I was going to Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. And I needed like a job just to pay for college. And I started doing graphic design because I had a copy of Photoshop and I thought I knew how to design. And I kind of did. I don't even know if I'd call what I did like designing. It was so ghetto in almost every way. But, you know, I just found myself doing stuff. And the real way that I got into doing all this was out of nowhere, some bands and some band managers started to like contact me on the internet. I had like a web page where I would just make sort of stupid t-shirt designs and stuff like that. And this band manager hit me up out of nowhere and asked me if I wanted to design some merchandise for their band. And then little by little, that kept turning into different stuff. And then the band really liked working with me. And it turned into like a situation where they're like, well, hey, do you want to direct a music video for us? And it just kind of kept like one thing kept leading to another. And the next thing I knew, when I graduated college, I didn't want to do anything with my history degree, which is actually really useful because you can't do anything with a history degree. Ended up with a job at an independent record label in Huntington Beach called Fearless Records. And they they had some acts like at the Drive-In and Plain White Tees and stuff like that. And it was just like the only job that I could find in the music business at the time, and it was for graphic design. And while I was there, I saved every penny that I made, and I would put it towards convincing bands that I would meet into letting me shoot music videos for them. And over the course of the 2 years that I spent at different record labels, I probably spent like $10,000 and on just, you know, all kinds of different music video projects. And I didn't really have any money to begin with either. I mean, I was sleeping on people's couches to get by and, you know, really like totally living paycheck to paycheck, but like seriously just eating ramen noodles all the time so I could make really low budget music videos for bands. And the reason they'd let me do it is because I'd come to them and I'd just say like, hey, I'll make a music video for you guys. There's no risk involved. You don't have to come up with a budget or anything. I'll pay for it myself. And, you know, the bands who let me do that, you know, hopefully it did some good stuff for them. But by the end of, you know, 2 or 3 years, I'd built enough of a reel to start talking to some production companies. And anyway, that's sort of the short or long version of how I got into it all, which I don't know if that's like a real normal way for music video directors to do it. I feel like all of my friends who direct music videos have gotten into it in like really weird ways. There's totally not a path
or like, no, definitely. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say, you know, you started in the music industry. Like, do you see the act, you know, kind of making music videos as being a part of the music industry more so than it is a part of the film industry?
Well, the one main way that it's really connected to the music industry is that, like, our budgets. And the acts that we work with are all a function of what's going on in the music industry right now. I was just talking to a friend of mine a couple of days ago and we were like kind of lamenting about the fact that there aren't a lot of huge alternative rock bands right now. Because traditionally in music videos, those are the bands that are kind of looking for something that's a little quirkier or a little bit more interesting from a like directorial standpoint. Not to say that like pop videos or urban videos can't be that, but just traditionally that's where that kind of stuff comes from. And, you know, it's mainly because in the music industry right now, that music isn't quite selling as well. And so that's one way in that like my job is almost completely dependent on like what is going on in music videos. And I mean, luckily we aren't doing just music videos too. Like, I, you know, every now and then we'll get a commercial job or we'll get some sort of, you know, TV opportunity or something like that. But in terms of music video stuff, like, you know, I do catch myself like reading the Billboard Top 100 or, you know, looking at stuff like that just to kind of see where everything's going. I don't know if other music video directors do that. I try not to talk about it too much because it's kind of nerdy, but it's like my job every day is to make bands interesting and their songs more appealing and stuff like that. So it's definitely tied in with the music industry. And, you know, I mean, we use the same crews as film stuff and, you know, obviously like some of the same equipment, but yeah, I guess in some ways we are like kind of a part of the industry.
Now for the first videos that you were sort of going to bands and saying, you know, hey, you know, let me make a music video basically. Is that sort of the era of, you know, the video for the Hot Rod Circuit and, you know, Rosie and the Gold Bug and those music videos, or is that earlier?
Yeah, no, it was like around there. And I don't know how we were doing it. And when I say we, I mean my producing partner, Steve Buchanan, who's basically produced everything I've ever done. He's a friend of mine from Arizona. He moved out here when I started making music videos. But when we first started doing it, I mean, that Hot Rod Circuit video, I don't even know how we did it. We shot it for like $10 million, or I'm sorry, $10,000. $10 million, perfect. $10,000, we shot it on film. We shot it over like 4 days. There were tons of locations. Like, we were just totally killing ourselves to get stuff done, and we were probably totally killing the crews and everything too. And we were shooting all that stuff in Arizona too, which is way cheaper. Locations are more readily available, stuff like that. So that was a big part of those initial videos, was just also like us kind of figuring out how to make a music video.
But the video for the Hot Rod Circuit Stateside, which I highly recommend, because it does look like you guys were killing yourselves because it looks so, you know, physically complicated. It's and if you haven't seen the video, you know, the band members are all sort of conjoined twins and they're doing things as conjoined twins. I mean, were you a little nervous sort of taking on projects of that kind of complexity early on?
Well, this was at a time where I was still, you know, figuring out how to direct things. I was kind of like faking my way through it. And, you know, a lot of the directors that, who did music videos that I kind of admired at the time, I didn't know a lot of them by name, but like guys like Spike Jonze and Michel Gondry, they were always doing stuff that looked like it was really complicated. And that was like part of the fun for me in watching them. And I think what I didn't realize at the time is that they had huge budgets. And it wasn't just that they were geniuses, but they also had what it took in order to make those things really happen. And so that was part of the learning process for me too. Like in that video towards the end, we had to actually chop down a 80-foot pine tree in the middle of a forest in Arizona. And to me, I was like, well, I've seen stuff like that in music videos and commercials before. You know, I was like 22 or 23 at the time and I had no idea. And I was like, yeah, we can totally make that happen. And I don't know how he did it, but Steve, my producer, made it happen. But, you know, I think one of the hardest lessons, especially right now with where the music video industry is at, where, you know, the economy is at, is figuring out how to do stuff like that, but to do it on a small budget and to do it in ways that aren't quite as risky.
And when you say risky, I mean, what do things like that? Do you mean something that has, you know, an impact in terms of, you know, either online views or, you know, people talking about it and passing it around or more of like an artistic impact?
Well, I mean, risky, then this is probably the most boring way of looking at it, but risky in terms of like, can we actually pull it off? Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, like I always want to do ideas that people will talk about. I always want to do ideas that are like, you know, extremely challenging for me. And I feel like we've been successful at doing that, but you know, it's a risk for the record label and for the band when they hire a director to make a music video for them. You know, they're kind of the band's putting their career in your hands. If you come out with a really great music video for them, it might do great things. If you, you know, make a really horrible video and none of it turns out right, it could be like, you know, a really bad thing for their career. And I would hate to do that to a band. So I'm always, you know, trying to find things that we can for sure pull off. And so the day of the shoot, we aren't like, hey, we just, you know, flushed a bunch of your money down a toilet. Sorry about that, you know? Because, I mean, that is one of the things about music videos. Like, we hear stories about that all the time about, well, this director came up with a really great idea. It was something that had never been done before. It totally, you know, it's Michel Gondry-esque or whatever. And then they weren't quite able to pull it off for the budget, or, you know, when they finally put it together in the edit, it didn't come out right or something like that. So there is like an inherent risk in trying things that are more complicated, which is probably a reason why a lot of music videos are just like a band playing in a warehouse or something like that. Cause it's simple to do and it's easy and it's been done a million times and you know, you can pull that off for the budget. So like the thing that I'm always trying to do with music videos is find a way to like come up with like really crazy ideas or come up with something that's really interesting to look at, but then to also like make sure that it's something that we can like really do and really pull off in an awesome way.
You also take a risk when you come up with these complicated ideas that the band is going to be able to pull it off. Are they considered before you come up with a kind of a really complex idea that requires the band to pull off, being a conjoined twin or, you know, reenacting a Sylvester Stallone movie? Is that something that you have to consider first before you come up with those ideas?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that the best music videos are usually for the bands who want the best music videos. I think some bands look at a music video as just like one of five or six different things they're going to do to market their album or whatever, and they don't take it very seriously, and they just kind of show up. I mean, I've been in situations like that where the band will show up the day of the shoot, and they'll be like, what are we doing again? Like, they haven't even like read the idea. They don't, you know, they're like, I'm doing what? And then there are other bands like Cage the Elephant is a really good example. It's a band that I've worked with three times now where the lead singer is so involved. Like, we'll we'll spend all night on the phone talking about an idea. We'll go over it for hours and hours and hours, and he'll call me out of nowhere and be like, oh, well, what if we did this? Or, you know, just coming up with stuff like all the time, all the way up until the day of the shoot. And then being there the day of the shoot, like he wants the video to be as good as I do. Usually I feel like I'm the one who cares the most, and on shoots with that band in particular, Cage the Elephant, they're just so enthusiastic about making really good stuff. And I think that that really does help to, you know, it makes sure that their performances are really good, but it also just kind of helps overall. Like, they really care. And I think it sounds funny. Like, you think, oh, this is a professional band. They're on a major record label. Like, of course they would care about their music video, but you know, I'd say it's like 50-50 most of the time. You just never know. So if you have a band that really is like totally down for making an amazing music video and really invested in it, that is like a super helpful thing that a music video director can't really take for granted.
Do you find that bands like that are more or less willing to defer to you as the director of the video? You know, a lot of times it's a band and it's their video and they want to, you know, be the directors themselves too. Do you find that the bands that are really enthusiastic also are able to, you know, kind of see that order there?
Yeah, most of the time. There are times where, I mean, I think every video you kind of have to like win over the trust of the band a little bit. Like, you have to, they have to be able to see that you're going to make good decisions, that you're going to work really hard, stuff like that. There was one situation last year where I was talking with a band, and I won't say who, but they were so intent on doing their own idea. And you know, sometimes that just happens and I'll go with it. And I look at my job then is to like take their idea and turn it into something that's like really great. But they were so involved in every tiny little detail and every aspect of the video that, you know, I finally just kind of had to like throw up my hands and sort of like take a step back and put it in their hands, just because it looked like it wasn't going to work with me. You know, I mean, I didn't completely check out, but I kind of had to be like, I'm not going to get my vision across in this video, and that's fine. And that's just the way it's going to be, because, you know, some of those battles, like, you can fight them a little bit, and some of them, like, it's just not completely worth it to do that.
So the video actually ended up happening.
Yeah, it ended up happening. I think I kind of found out a little too late that they were sort of that mindset. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it really does work. Sometimes a band will have great ideas, and when they come to you with them, they're willing to compromise on certain things. And sometimes those ideas are great. This band in particular had awful ideas. They wanted to make like a video that I felt wasn't interesting and was really cheesy. So, you know, it's not on my reel, I'll tell you that. But it's something that still got made, and that's part of it too. Like, when it comes down to it, I like, it's my job. Like, sometimes I like to think of myself as an artist, but you know, this is like also the way that I make my living. And you know, it's sometimes it's not quite as glamorous, I guess.
I'm looking at at some later point in the interview, I'm going to say, like, I really love this music video, and it's going to be that music video. So just like tug your ear if it's that one.
No, it's something that like I totally took my name off of. So oh, okay. I don't even think anybody can look it up online and see that it's connected to me.
We need to have it on Filmed Insert though. We strive for completeness.
Oh man.
And speaking of sort of different individual music videos, I thought we could talk about a few of them in the canon, so to speak.
Cool.
And one of them that Doug and I are really big fans of, because it's just such a, you know, fantastic, sort of like, I don't know, mesmerizing, you know, interesting, and also like really humorous video, is the Manchester Orchestra Shake It Out video. And if, you know, it's not really apparent when you watch the video, but we'll link to it in the podcast show notes. There is a great director's commentary where you talk about the beginnings of it, and you mentioned that it is based on the 1987 movie Over the Top with Sylvester Stallone. And I just like to read the IMDb short blurb of that. And it's Lincoln Hawk is a struggling trucker who's trying to rebuild his life. After the death of his wife, He tries to make amends with his son, who he left behind years earlier. Upon their first meeting, his son doesn't think too highly of him until he enters the nationwide arm wrestling competition in Las Vegas. Now, I guess the question that pops to mind is, how, first of all, where do you go from a sort of this cult 80s movie with Sylvester Stallone that, you know, 99% of the population hasn't heard of and think, we're not even only going to remake it, but we're going to remake it in music video form. Were you a big fan of that film, or did somebody else suggest it?
You know, I saw that movie. I think that movie was like on TNT nonstop when I was growing up, but I didn't have cable, so I never saw it growing up. And when I got to college, all my friends had seen it, and I'd never even heard of it. And it is totally like one of those classic, like, so bad that it's good kind of cult 80s movies. And I remember watching it and being really mesmerized by it, and in sort of an ironic way, but also like it's a very sincere movie. And there's something that's kind of like sweet about how simple it is. And I mean, this dude is solving all of his life problems by arm wrestling, and it's almost like it's like a film written by like a 15-year-old who's just kind of starting to understand how the world works. And like, he's, you know, like, who would ever even think that there is such a thing as like a world like competition for arm wrestling where there's like, it's as big as like WWF and there's like millions of screaming fans and like huge prize at stake. Like, you know, all that stuff's just so like, I don't know. It's just so, There's something ridiculous about it and kind of sincere and cool about it too. And I don't want to like philosophize too much here. I don't know if philosophize is a word either, but
it is on this podcast.
Okay, cool. Thanks, guys. But you know, I really loved it was a movie that I ended up watching a lot. My friend got it for me on DVD, and I would just kind of throw it in like late night and just kind of chuckle. And I think like when I first heard that Manchester Orchestra song, they said they wanted to try something that was kind of funny because I guess in the past they had done stuff that was a little bit more serious and they didn't want to get pegged as a band that only did serious music videos. And, you know, it was actually a treatment that I had pitched to someone else before and they said it was too far out there, but I thought, man, I really want to do this idea. And just listening to the song, I was like, I think we could do something really cool with it. And watching the video now, like, I'm so happy because I think not only is it kind of funny, it has some humorous moments, but like, especially towards the end, like, I really feel like it kind of captures that like sincerity. And like, there is something sort of beautiful about him winning that really stupid competition and getting his son back and winning the girl and all that stuff. And I don't know. We had a really fun time with that music video. It was a really fun one to make.
I think a lot of where that sincerity comes from is from the performance of Ryan Hull, because that he was, I think that's kind of what carries it the whole, like, he's super, like, you couldn't have asked for a better band member who's an actor.
The lead singer, Andy.
Oh, Andy Hull.
No, yeah, yeah.
I said, wait, hold on. Andy Hull. Adam's going to fix that in post.
Dude, you guys have so much to fix in post. This is me. It's gonna be like a 5-minute interview. You know, he was great, and it was kind of like an interesting story from that. Is that that was a 2-day shoot, and at the end of the first day of shooting, he takes like some medications for different things, and he like lost his medication, and we were somewhere in Nashville, and he was very kind of like emotional and a little upset the next day. And it really comes through in the performance. Like when you watch it, like he's giving like probably one of the most like emotional performances in a music video. And like there were scenes that would end with him like kind of tearing up and stuff. And I was like, geez, this is like totally ridiculous, but it came out so awesome on, you know, in the edit. And he was one of those guys who totally invested his whole self into making sure that music video turned out great. And,
yeah, I think that phone booth scene, I think I probably start tearing up when it's just really, yeah, you're right.
He's and the great cool. thing is, if you haven't seen the movie, you have no clue what they're talking about,
That's the best part. I think, like, if you go to, like, YouTube and, like, read the comments and stuff, some people are like, oh, yeah, like, there's probably, like, a generational thing there where, like, older people will see it and be like, oh, yeah, it's awesome, Sylvester Stallone, over the top. And then other people who are just like, I don't think this really goes with the lyrics, but okay. You know, like, so I think we might have confused some younger fans who are yet to have seen the Criterion Collection release of Over the Top, but
which there is one.
Oh, there will be someday, I'm sure. But you know, I think that's part of the fun of it too, is that if you haven't seen it, it still is just like a really fun story, and I don't know, we have some goofy fun with it, and I don't know, it's when I look back at it, it was probably one of the most fun music videos to actually make, just because we had so much fun with the performances.
Speaking of sort of a intense kind of emotional music video, out of, you know, the music videos you've done, I think the one that stands out to me is the Cage the Elephant Shake Me Down video. And if you haven't seen it, I encourage everybody to go check it out, because it I think it's one of the only ones in your catalog that really is, you know, pretty much a straight, you know, I hesitate to call it sentimental, but it really goes for a more of an emotional impact. Was that something that you were, you know, interested in doing, or was that something that the band was sort of putting up as sort of a prerequisite for making the video?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one for me. I think, you know, right around the time I did the Manchester Orchestra video, I started to realize that, I mean, I really love making music videos that are funny or just kind of have like sort of an interesting twist or something like that. But I think I really enjoy like watching music videos that aren't afraid to be kind of sincere in that way. But one of my favorite music video directors over the last couple of years has been Chris Milk, who has done some really great work. He did like a couple of the first Kanye West videos, and he's done all kinds of cool stuff since then. And his stuff's always been like really, it's always like been so brave, I think, because it's right on that edge of like, if you push it too far, it gets sappy. And I feel like he's so good at finding just the right tone to make a music video that actually sort of resonates emotionally. And I felt after I did the Manchester Orchestra video, like it wasn't my intent for that to be anything but just kind of fun. And towards the end, like in the edit, like I was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I'm getting chills like watching some of these scenes. And I wanted to like kind of develop that side of what I can do as a director more. And so I think in the project since then, that's come out. And I think that Shake Me Down video was a really good opportunity for me to explore that more too. Cause you know, honestly, you don't get a lot of opportunities in music videos to write an idea that is kind of that serious. I mean, that's a music video that's about, a guy like, basically seeing his whole life flash before his eyes before he dies. And in the end, he really dies. Spoiler alert. But like, that's, you know, that's really going out on a limb. If you're the band, to put out something like that, that's kind of like a bummer or whatever, you know, like whatever I'm sure their record label is saying about the video. But I think it really resonated with fans, and it's cool. It really gave me an opportunity to do something where, you know, I'm proud of it as like a dramatic piece too. I think it's shot really well. We had a really good time with the art direction, but I mean, we spent a lot of time on those performances, and, you know, we cast some really cool actors. We shot that on location in, a little town outside of Nashville. And I mean, there are scenes in there where, you know, it's not often you get to like shoot a realistic death scene for a music video or something like that. And so that was a great opportunity to kind of like flex that side a little bit more of what I can do as a director. And a lot of that comes again from the band, like allowing me to, you know, try something a little risky. And that's my third video for Cage the Elephant. I don't know if I could have done that on my first video with them. Like it required so much trust, I think, to do something like that, that it only could have come after having like a real like relationship with them as a band.
And how did that relationship develop? Was it just a process of, you know, for the first, I think it was Back Against the Wall was the first video. And then after that, they just kept coming back to you, and it develops like that. Is that sort of how, you know, we actually, Doug and I talk a lot about sort of great to, you know, partnerships between bands and music video directors and how that can really improve the product over time. Is that, do you see it sort of developing like that? Is it how it developed with you and Cage the Elephant?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the hardest parts about my job is pitching ideas. And I feel like I can pitch ideas that are a little more out there if I already have a relationship with the band. You know, if it's just like, I get something from a record label and they're like, here's a brand new band. They need a cool idea. Come up with one. I've maybe never even heard of the band before. It's difficult for me to like pitch something to them that maybe does kind of go into like riskier territory just because they don't know who I am. I mean, I could be like a complete weirdo, pitching and, you know, pitching an idea to them, or like, you know, a lot of times it can come down to like sensibilities, like a sense of humor or something like that. Like if a band maybe doesn't completely get my sense of humor yet or something like that, or there's just, you know, there's only so much you can communicate in like a 5-page script with a couple images put into it. So for like Cage the Elephant, like the last two videos I've done for them, the lead singer will just call me and be like, hey, it's time to make a music video. What do you want to do? You know, or he'll have some ideas and be like, what do you think of these? And that's just, it's just such a better way of making things in general. And there's no other way that you can do that without already having a prior relationship with the band.
Yeah, I know. That seems like it would be really, really freeing, and that definitely makes a lot of sense. And on the other side of that, and one that we wanted to mention quickly, because I think it's sort of one of those videos that, you have such a varied, you know, catalog of music videos. This one kind of errs on the side of, you know, a little bit more like the viral, kind of viral internet music video, which is the Pistol Youth In My Eyes video. And if you haven't seen it, it is. The entire video is clips of the Golden Girls, the TV show from the 80s and 90s, with the faces of the band members sort of grafted onto the Golden Girls. And more specifically with that, you know, you look at a video like that and you see the editing and you see sort of the visual effects work that goes into that. Where does sort of the direction come into a video like that?
Well, you know, I should say that so much of that video's execution came from our really good friend Dave Torno, who's just like an incredible genius when it comes to post effects. And he donated like 2 months of his life to getting that band's face all over the Golden Girls in every scene. I mean, I've seen people try that stuff before and seen people try it since. And it really, like, it just comes down to, like, how awesome Dave was with pulling those effects off.
Yeah, it is really, really convincing.
Oh, thanks. But, you know, it was an idea that I'd wanted to do for a long time. I'm actually friends with Bradley, the lead singer of that band. He used to be in a band called Stereogram that was signed to Capitol Records a little while ago. And they had some cachet kind of as being like the first band in an iTunes commercial. They had sort of like a hit single that Michel Gondry directed the video for. And then he wanted to go and try something new. So he started this band. So he had a history of doing like music videos that were a little bit more out there. And his band happened to be on a label in his home country of New Zealand, who didn't really care about copyright laws very much, I guess. So when I pitched his idea to him, I mean, this is something I never could have done through, like, you know, Universal Records or Sony or Capitol out here. When I first pitched this idea to Bradley, I was like, okay, wouldn't this be hilarious? So my pitch just was a picture of the Golden Girls with his face on all of them. And he has my sense of humor, and we enjoy a lot of the same, like, TV shows and stuff. And so he instantly thought it was great. And I was like, well, but will your record label let us do this? Like, you know, they're totally going to get sued or something. Like NBC is going to come after them. And the record label, I don't know, maybe they're just more lax about copyright law or something in New Zealand, but it never was a problem. And the second they were like, oh, don't worry about it, we'll handle it if anything comes up, we were just like, okay. And we went for it. But yeah, that idea was just something I'd been kicking around for a long time. And, I'd always wanted to do something like that. I always thought the Golden Girls was a really creepy show growing up. There's just something about it that's so weird. It's like these old people living in a bubble of pastel. And I don't know, like the stench of death is just all over that show. It's weird. But, you know, it was like a really the process of directing it was like so tedious. It was really awful. We spent an entire day. I had already picked out all the clips that I wanted to insert Bradley, the lead singer, into. And we spent an entire day with him in front of a green screen, shooting every single shot in order from just the right angle as he lip syncs just the right word. And then to make it even more difficult, we shot it at like 60 frames a second, which means we're shooting it in slow motion so that our effects artist had more material to work with. So all day it's him, you know, like droning out syllables in front of a green screen. And the first couple takes, it was like, oh wow, this is so crazy, this is gonna look awesome. And then by the end of the day, everybody was just so exhausted, and you're hearing the song get played back in like 5 second increments, like really slowly.
Oh man,
it was just so I don't know, by the end of the day the whole crew looked like zombies. It was really bad. But, you know, between that and then Dave Torno, our effects guy, having to, like, sit there in front of his computer literally for 2 months, I think, like, all of November and December of that year, that's all he worked on for us. It was one of those things that I hope looks really fun and effortless when people watch it. But, man, I would never volunteer to do a video like that again.
It does look effortless, which is the great thing about it. Dave's work, or Dave Torno's work on that is really spectacular, because you're right. I have seen videos where it's pulled off not as well, and it really, really takes you out of it. But that sounds like a great idea for a behind-the-scenes video. It was just maybe a 45-minute long video of clips of you guys just from a day, just like wanting to, you know, shoot yourself after.
yeah, that would get a lot of hits.
And So
world's saddest crew.
the last video I wanted to mention is one that I believe it is the most recent one, because the movie is coming out and it's unique for a number of reasons. And it is the, I want to make sure I get their name right here.
Oh, the band is Atomic Tom.
Atomic Tom, yeah. Sorry, yeah. I was floundering with my notes.
We're thinking of getting names wrong here.
Yeah, we're awesome at that.
That's fine.
Yeah, so it's the video for Atomic Tom, Don't You Want Me, from the movie Take Me Home Tonight, starring the lovely Anna Faris, lovely if you're a girl, Topher Grace, and some other people. But it seems like a really rare and interesting opportunity, because number one, it's for a motion picture, and there's a sort of a really direct tie there, and there's sort of a history of kind of making regular music videos, the sort of I don't want to miss a thing trope, where you have, you know, the music video, then you have clips of the movie in there, and you're also working with actors who are used to working on, you know, motion picture films, you know, the multi-million dollar ones. So I was really interested to hear, you know, what your experience was with that, and you know, A, would you ever do it again, and B, you know, how you felt about the finished product.
Oh man. Yeah, that video was a weird one. That was totally like a, I don't know, once every like 10 years sort of thing. Topher Grace had seen some videos that I had done, and he called me up one day and he just said, we have a movie coming out. It's like a movie about the 1980s. I've always wanted to do a music video that has like the whole cast from a movie, which really is like a very 80s thing to do. I think I still haven't seen it, but he said like the entire cast of St. Elmo's Fire was in some music video one time or something like that, which would be like huge because all these giant stars. But he had me come up with some concepts. We talked about it for a little while, and then we finally just ended up on this concept that he had wanted to do, I think, pretty much the whole time, which was we're gonna just parody, or not really parody, but like pay homage to as many classic 80s movies as possible in 3 minutes. And this was still during a time where they were trying to put together the movie's soundtrack too. So to add like an additional degree of difficulty, they hadn't even picked out which band was going to play the song. Atomic Tom is like a really cool band, super nice guys. They're kind of like an internet sensation. They did a video a couple months ago that kind of put them in the spotlight, where they were like on a subway in New York playing songs.
I think.
Yeah, they were playing one of their songs on like iPhones, they didn't have instruments. It was just like all of them playing on iPhones. And it was totally like a really cool viral video. And Topher had seen it, thought they'd be perfect for it. But they didn't even have the song recorded on the day of the video shoot. They were still in the process of doing that. So it was like a really difficult shoot because we didn't even know who the band was going to be until like 2 days before we shot it. Yeah, they got the whole cast of the movie together to do all these homages, and we spent probably more preparation for this music video than any music video I'd ever done before. Usually, I mean, there are times where like you'll shoot a music video like 3 days after it's been approved by the record label, and there's like everything's getting thrown together and it's really fast. I mean, that's 3 days is like really, really fast. But, you know, even like it's not uncommon to shoot a music video like 7 days after you kind of, you know, get the paperwork and everything set in motion. So this we found out about 4 or 5 weeks before the actual shoot. And this was one where, you know, I was telling you guys before, like the band's involvement usually dictates the success of a video to a certain degree. And here, like, it was Topher Grace just like being a maniac. He was so involved in this, and he called me like I think on Christmas Eve, and we talked for like 3 hours about all the 80s movies that he loved. We were compiling this list, and I mean it's incredible because like as a director you definitely want like the people you're directing to be, you know, super excited about what you're doing. But I was like, wow, man, like Topher Grace is a celebrity. Like, shouldn't he be doing something like, I don't know, shouldn't he be like in Maui or something or Parker? Why is he calling me on Christmas Eve?
To talk about like just like E.T. and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, man, I really love E.T.
Yeah, totally. He was getting so into it too. Like, he is like a huge movie buff. And especially from that era too, like he knows every line from Back to the Future and all that stuff. So we talked about it for a really long time, and then we had like multiple fittings to make sure that all the costumes were right. I mean, one of the most difficult things to do in a music video is to have like a ton of different setups. This was a music video where I think we had 60 or 64 setups to shoot in 2 days. And that's just like so much to cram in there. And our crew did really great job. I mean, it was like a marathon. Just to make the video at all was like a huge challenge. So, but man, it couldn't have turned out better. I was so excited with, you know, the response that it got was great. I think it ended up being viewed more times online than the actual trailer of the movie, which is totally, it's awesome to see something really take off like that.
And from a practical standpoint, you said, you know, it was kind of a slog for the actual shooting, and the whole thing is sort of a party. How do you keep that, as a director, how do you keep that party atmosphere sort of going and believable?
Well, that probably was the hardest. Well, no, that definitely wasn't the hardest part, but that was something that was like always in the back of our minds as we were shooting. And you know, one thing that I kind of learned over the last 2 years, especially, is, you know, a lot of times directors will sort of take advantage of their power and kind of yell at people and stuff. And, you know, you hear stories about like directors throwing chairs to get the performance that they want, or screaming or belittling people. And I mean, that's totally not my style anyway. But I think, you know, if you want to like keep up sort of a vibe that looks excited or happy on set, I almost feel like you have to just be really, really nice to people. And all day long, like we were trying, I told my crew that day, I was like, one of my goals is to make sure that we're treating this room full of sweaty, underpaid, overworked extras excited, like genuinely happy to be there. And one of the coolest things about that video is when I watch it, you know, anytime I watch one of my videos, it's impossible for me to separate how I felt the day of shooting. And even though that was a grueling day to shoot, we still had a really great time. And it was fun. Like, we would set up, you know, Topher would get out there dressed up like Michael J. Fox. you know, as Marty McFly or something like that. And he would perform his take a couple different times, and we'd, you know, change some things up and try out different material. And the whole time, it's almost like you're performing in front of like a live studio audience, because that crowd of people that's there the whole time, you know, they're giving you a genuine response. And I feel like it was so important for us to, you know, to really try to treat them well, and to make sure that they're having a good time, so that it wasn't a manufactured excitement or a manufactured joy that was kind of coming out. I hope not. I mean, it's a long time to stand in one place for, gosh, like two straight days of 12 hours each.
Well, Isaac, thank you so much for sitting down with us. This is really, really cool. And if you want to check out more of or check out Isaac's video, all you have to do is search for Isaac Rents at the little search bar on Filmed Insert, or everything is up at isaacrents.com. And actually, Isaac, you have a pretty awesome distinction in that you have a Wikipedia page dedicated to you, which is not easy to get. So I highly recommend going to Isaac's Wikipedia page and writing some cool stuff about him. Maybe some stuff that you've just learned in this very podcast.
Yeah, you could find Wikipedia at wikipedia.com.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Voice number for the podcast.
Yeah, we do. That's a good idea. Well, while we're doing that, why don't we do some picks O of the week? And actually, we're recording this on St. Patrick's Day, so it's officially picks O of the week.
Yeah, that is what it is. It is picks O of the week, and this week Adam's gonna lead us off.
All right, let's do it. My pick of the week. This is in like my top five music videos of all time, because I just think this is a awesomely brilliant music video, and I hope one day we can get the director of it on the podcast, because I would love to talk to him. And the music video is for MGMT's Time to Pretend, and it is directed by Ray Tintori. And the concept of the music video is very hard to describe, because they use sort of like really lo-fi green screen effects to really great effect. You know, they'll be on the beach, and then they'll just do a really sort of choppy and lo-fi like green screening of the sky. There's a lot of really strange and really, again, lo-fi effects. They're like riding cats, but anyway, they're sort of like these kind of night, sort of like dream world tribal people. And it's actually the music video is where the cover from MGMT's album that the song comes from is from. So you'll recognize, you know, the swim trunks with the little squiggly lines on in front of it. But I like it because the music, the actual song Time to Pretend, has such like an energy and this ridiculous flow to it. And I think this is the way this video is done is one of those rare music videos where it's like the only way, after you see it, it's like, yeah, this is the only way you can sort of capture the energy of that song with those visuals. So, again, it's MGMT, Time to Pretend, and the director is Ray Tintori.
That's a really great pick, I'd say.
Doug, you turned me on to MGMT. I love them. They're fantastic.
You're welcome, I'd say. I'd say that it's time for my pick of the week. So I'm gonna give it to you. And hopefully my streak of having my pick of the week be the director we interview in a future podcast remains true, because I'm a big fan of this director. And actually, before I say it, I realized that actually one of your picks of the week ended up being an interview once. Because your pick of the week on the very first podcast was Matt Wells.
Oh, nice.
And then after that, so we're pretty good at this thing here of picking who we interview. So my pick of the week is a music video for Lenny Kravitz, and it's for a song called Let Love Rule. I believe the song features Justice in some way. I'm not very familiar with Lenny Kravitz music. However, I am familiar with this awesome video directed by Keith Schofield. And the basic concept of the video is it's like it plays like it's the last maybe 20 seconds of what would be like a 80s style action movie. And then the credits start to roll. The very last line of the movie is "Let Love Rule." You gotta let love rule, I think it is. And then the song "Let Love Rule" begins to play. And the main character of this quote movie is kind of just initially just kind of like strutting down the street as the credits roll. And then eventually he begins interacting with the credits. He first catches his sleeve on them, and then he like starts hanging up laundry on them and like kind of crawling up them and letting them drag him up the screen and stuff. And it's kind of a really the whole kind of video at first, the initial concept of the video is having it be the kind of closing credits theme song of an 80s movie in itself is kind of a funny concept. And then the fact that the character is interacting with the credits, it's really, the effects are really cool. It's really interesting, and it gets really, really cool to watch and see the different things he does with the credits and the different problems he encounters with having credits rolling across his life. So check this video out because I like it.
That's an awesome, fantastic music video. I love it, and definitely check it out. The links will be in the show notes, the blog post for this Filmed Insert podcast, episode 5. We hope you enjoy it. And from Boston, from the great state of Massachusetts, and Delray Beach from the great state of Florida, we're saying goodbye and until next week.
Everyone, enjoy your meals.
Feel your heartbeat faster. Take me home tonight. I don't wanna let you go till you feel the light. Take me home tonight. Listen,
you said you said take me home tonight, kind of like in a Christopher Walken kind of way. You're like, take me home tonight. Like there was like no punctuation.
Well, that's in that. This is a behind the scenes thing because I've got like 40 tabs open on Chrome on my browser, and one of them is the IMDb page for Take Me Home Tonight, and I can only see Take Me Home, and I was like, Take Me Home, and then I was like, ah, Tonight, definitely.
Yeah, it's definitely that, because that's an 80s song. My question is, they remade a song for the movie that already existed. Why didn't they remake Take Me Home Tonight?
That's a good question. And actually, when I was in high school, I was in two bands. One of them was called 3-9 Line.
I can't believe you found that. You went back and found that in your head. Okay.
Oh man, I'm not losing this time. And the other was a band called, that was when I was in high school. And then I was in like this joke band kind of called Albinos in the Sun. And Vinny was our lead singer. And it was just really me and him, but we would always, like, my brother is a solid pro, like, jazz musician. He was, like, an incredible musician, and he always, you know, in high school, he always had all these really fantastic musicians around. So we would, like, basically commandeer them and make music, or make them record little bits and stuff like that. Anyway, one of I think the only track that survives of anything we did is a cover of Take Me Home Tonight, and it's actually... none of Derek's great jazz friends are on it, just so I don't like besmirch their good name, but I'll play the song as, you know, as an outro to the podcast.
What's really great is because you've so smoothly integrated the fact that I talked shit about that other music video not remaking the right song. Now that all has to be in there. Thanks.
No problem.